This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Hey everyone, I'm going to get us started. Welcome to the fall seminar series. I'm Steve Seibold. I'm an affiliate with the department, and I work for the U.S. Forest Service here in town. And I have the pleasure of introducing Egan Chen, who works in our lab. Egan, of course, was trained in China. He got his bachelor's degree from South China Agricultural University in plant protection. He also got a master's there in agricultural entomology. And then he went to the University of Georgia, where he did a PhD on trichrophic interactions with beet armyworm, cotton, and a parasitoid. And the key question there was, how does nitrogen fertilization affect those interactions? And he did a little transitional thing. He was in agricultural entomology and started working on pecan trees, and I think that's how we hooked him on forest entomology and tree insects. So he did a brief postdoc there at Georgia, and then went on to Michigan State University, where he worked in our sister laboratory in the Forest Service in East Lansing. And there he worked on emerald ash borer, which is one of our primary invasive forest insects now. It's a major, major pest. We've dumped a lot of money into that. So he worked on nutritional ecology, a little chemical ecology with emerald ash borer, and kind of attracted our attention because we had a similar species here, the gold spotted oak borer. So when his project ran out there, we were able to snag him, and he came here to Davis in 2011. And has worked for several years on gold spot oak borer, published several really good papers, and has moved our program forward. More recently now, he's working on the Polyphagus shot oak borer, which is another pest that's coming to Southern California, invasive. This one's from Asia, and it's Ambrosiaville. He'll include that in his presentation. So his talk today is going to web all that together. He's been here long enough that we've promoted him to an associate project scientist for postdoctoral scientists. And he's going to put all those pieces together in this presentation, interactions of invasive wood-boring beetles with their host hardwood trees. Egan? I'll turn the lights
on. Thank you, Stu, for your detailed introduction. Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you all for coming. And I would also thank the department and Dr. Stu Nedler for the invitation. It's a great opportunity for me to share some of my research in the past 6 years. And today I will cover three invasive wood-boring beetles and use them as examples to illustrate some specific insect plant interactions. So the first beetle is emerald ash borer, EAB. It's host plants ash trees in the genus Fraxinus. And it's now in eastern and midwestern USA. It was introduced from Northeastern Asia. And when I was working at Michigan State University as a postdoc, I was interested in nutritional, chemical, and behavioral interactions between EAB and ash trees. So today I'm going to show you one of the interesting behavior of EAB, a larval feeding behavior, and its driving force. And the second video is good spotted oak borer, Chisel. Host plants are oak trees in the genus Cocos. It's now in San Diego County, California. It was introduced from southeastern Arizona. And for any invasive species, the first critical step for eradication is to detect them early. So in the past 3 years, working at UC Davis, we focused on visual and chemical interaction between oak trees and chisop in an attempt to develop trapping lures for odor detection. And the third beetle is prolific shortbill borer. And this beetle attacks many hardwoods. And it's an ambrosial beetle, which means they feed on a fungi and instead of plant tissues. It's now in Southern California. It was introduced from Southeastern Asia. So we started this project this year, and I will show you our preliminary results on host range testing and plant signal-based loop development. So what's common about these three beetles? First, they are all wood-borne insects, beetle attacks main stem. So according to this book chapter by Bill Mason, who is a prominent forest anthropologist, and wood-borne insects that are attacking main stem are most damaging among all insect feeding guilds. EAD alone has killed tens of millions ash trees in USA. So I will show you two examples here. One is the EAD, and this shows compares the ash trees 3 years after the introduction of EAD, and all ash trees on that tree has been wiped out. And the second picture shows oak trees killed by whose live oak trees killed by chisel in San Diego County. And what's common about these three beetles, they all attack hardwood trees. As we know, hardwood trees are well known for their strength and the resilience, and they are widely used for flooring, furniture, and so on many other uses. And many hardwood trees are also really important as feeder trees. For example, ash trees comprise 5 to 10% of feeder trees in North America. So let me first talk about the emerald ash borer EAD. An emerald ash borer is so called because the emerald color on the full body. Here is an egg. Eggs hatch, then tunnel through the bark and make a S-shaped galleries. And EAD has 4 larval stages, and they overwinter as a pupa. And the EAD is native to Asia, northeastern Asia, including China, Japan, and Korea. In North America, it was first discovered in Detroit area in Michigan, probably through woodpecking material. And later the same year, it was discovered in Ontario or Canada. And in USA, since its introduction, it has been spreading to neighboring states. For example, in 2003, the spread to Ohio, 2004, Indiana. And to 2013, the spread to the westmost states in USA and Colorado State. And to the south, spread to Arkansas and Georgia. Host plants and all ash trees native to eastern US, they are susceptible. And some species, examples of eastern species are white ash, black ash, green ash. These three are most widely distributed ash trees in USA. In western and southwestern USA, there are more ash species, but their distribution is much more limited. And examples of western species are single leaf ash, California ash, Oregon ash, tropical ash. So this EAB attacks trees of all sizes, so ranging diameter, ranging from 2 centimeters to 1.5 meters. This slide shows the distributions of ash trees in natural forests. So I want to stress its distribution in natural forests. The distribution in urban settings is not available. So as we can see, the most widely distributed trees are 3 eastern species. Black ash is mainly in northeastern USA. White ash in eastern half, and green ash is a distribution, it's a wild. In the western species, we have single leaf ash mainly distributed in Utah, and they are quite few in California. Bareback ash mainly distributed in Arizona, and also some in California. So in California, we mainly have California ash and Oregon ash in west coast, Northern California and Sierra Nevada. So this seen from this picture, California is connected to the westmost states that EAD has been detected, Colorado, by from the ash species. So it will be interesting to see if in the next few years EAD keeps spreading to the west, either through natural disposal or human-aided introduction as shown in this cartoon. And usually human-aided introduction was much faster than natural disposal. Here are the EID dengue symptoms, the D-shaped erythematosus, it's really characteristic, and many of the blastids, like the good spotted ultraborus that I talked just a second, also has the same shape as the pole. And what type of damages? What types are after the larvae? Clown dieback, all these branches have been there. Sometimes one will see many economic shoots corrosive inside. And the internal symptoms or S-shaped or zigzagging damages. Here is an illustration, cross-section of water structure. The parts that the EAD feed include vascular cambium, lymphoem, and cork cambium. And the consequence of damage to these parts that the nutrient and water transport is interrupted. And as a result, trees usually will kill in 3 to 4 years. And in a study looking at how the EAD larvae affect ash tree chemistry, I found that most of the larvae emerging from, hatched from pinned eggs, they move downward to the root area. So here, the panel A shows the X, Y axis, the number of larvae, and Y axis of the two moving directions. And significantly more larvae move downward to the root area. Also, the biomass of the larvae moving downward is much greater than those moving upward. And in field collected trees from two parks in Michigan, and we observe the same behavior. So I want to know what's causing the downward moving behavior. And the answer to these questions might help us understand why what selection pressures that EAD larvae may face during their evolutionary arms race with ash tree. So the observed behavior is not because of gravity, because when seedlings were grown upside down, as we can see here, most of the beetles move upward, which is the root area. So these two spots, dark spots, indicate place that the eggs were pinned, and they are moving upward. Here shows more larvae move upward. And the observed behavior is not because of polyphenols. Polyphenols is a really big group of plant secondary defensive compounds that they can bind to soluble proteins and make them insoluble and invaluable to insects. So this picture axis is the duration of EAB larvae feeding from 10 days up to 50 days of continued feeding. And Y axis is the ratio of total polyphenols below the feeding side to above the feeding side. So samples were taken right below the feeding side and above the feeding side, then compared. So a ratio less than one as shown by undamaged control trees, like the black bar, as the white blank bars, indicate the concentrations of total polyphenols is less, below the feeding side is less than above the feeding side. However, EAB damage and after 40 days continued feeding, the ratio was increased to about 1, which means the total phenolic concentrations is greater below the feeding side than above the feeding side. And another line of evidence for polyphenols not being a causing factor is that EAB larvae can excrete the polyphenols to fresh the majority. And this figure shows X-axis is tree species reinvested, Y-axis is the total polyphenol concentration, either from phloem, which is the black bars, and grass, shaded bars. So majority of the polyphenols goes to grass. and also the bodies of the larval stages we tested. And moisture content might be one of the causing factors. And as you can see, for endangered control plants, the ratio is below the feeding cycle, above the feeding cycle is close to one consistently. EAD damages increase the ratio to greater than one, so which means the moisture content below the feeding cycle is greater than above the feeding cycle. So I want to see if moisture content affect larval development. And I set up an experiment with four different moisture content using artificial diet. So we I have 20, 40, 60, and 80% of moisture content. The panel A shows the mortality of larvae that build on artificial diets with lowest moisture content, 20%. Is greatest. And the panel B shows, in contrast, the biomass of the larvae reviewed on low moisture content, 20 and 40% are the lowest. So obviously, water moisture content is one causing factor. And nutrients might also be one of the causing factors. And 9 essential amino acids and 3 non-essential amino acids. The ratio was changed by EAB larval feeding. So the essential amino acids are amino acids that we humans or animals cannot manufacture on our own. We need to get them either from plants or other sources. And this shows one of the 9 essential amino acids for thiamine. And the ratio significantly has increased. Also, the artificial diet study indicates that nutrients play an important role for their development. So I have 4 treatments. One is control. The control has both casein. Casein is a protein source, and the yeast is a amino acid source. So control has both of them, and you need neither. The treatment has neither of them. So no casein, the treatment has yeast, and no yeast has protein. So they have either one of them. And the panel A shows the mortality again is highest on the treatments without casein nor yeast. In contrast, the biomass is the lowest for the diet without casein and yeast. So to summarize EAB's section, since its discovery in 2002, EAB has exploded more than fast, and it now has invaded half of the USA. EAB has killed tens of millions of ash trees and made key spreading to the west and to the south. And EAB larvae move downwards during their feeding and due to moisture content and nutrient availability. So let me switch to good spotted oak borer chisel. And good spotted oak borer has really distinctive 6 golden spots on the elytra, as EAB and chisel has 4 larval stages, and they overwinter as late stage larvae near the bark surface. And chisel was first discovered in San Diego County in 2004. However, it was not associated with oak mortality until 2008. And genetic analysis indicates the populations in San Diego is from southeastern Arizona, likely through firewood. Distributions in California, and it was spreading slowly in San Diego County, but it's still to 2014, it's limited to San Diego County. Although in November of 2012, there are a few trees found infested with chisel, but the trees was removed shortly. And after that, there are quite intensive surveys and they found nothing. So far, it's still restricted to San Diego County. Adaptive symptoms, well, it goes to behavior, and T-shirt, example, what neck damage, and clown eye back, as straight to the galleries. And one is different from behavior is bigger staining you will see on oak trees. And oak trees are broadly divided into red oaks, white oaks, and intermediate oaks. In oak woodland, in Southern California, in the field, one will find red oaks, including Coast Black Oak and California Black Oak, are much heavily infested than intermediate oak, which is Cape Black Oak. And there was almost no infestation on white oak, implement oak. However, in field, in laboratory, using no choice test, larval feeding, EAB larvae, they feed on red oak, white oak, and intermediate oaks. Although the damages on red oaks are generally greater than intermediate oak, which is further greater than white oaks. So this picture shows the X-axis are the oak species, and the gray bars represent red oaks. Black bars represent intermediate oaks, and white bars represent white oaks. The y-axis of panel A and C is a proportion of larvae that successfully established a gallery in no choice condition. And the y-axis of B, panel B and D are proportion successful larvae that survived to the final stages. So the proportion is pretty high in both in all the panel, and it can go about up to 25%. So in at Davis and UC Davis campus, you will often see a cock oak, which is an intermediate oak species, and a belly oak, which is a white oak species, and in laboratory, G-sub, they feed on both species. So if G-sub keeps spreading to the north, this species might be in danger. And oak distributions in California. So this is a zoom in of San Diego County. In San Diego County, you will see all four oak species. So the yellow patch represents implement oak. The white and the red one behind you is the California black oak. The blue one is Canyon Live Oak, and the green one the Coast Live Oak. So as we go, as we move up to north, we will see more susceptible oak species like Coast Live Oak, Canyon Live Oak, and California black oak. It's widely distributed in West Coast, Northern California, and Sierra Nevada. And G-sub prefers bigger trees. As we can see from this picture, none of the eight trees diagonal less than 15 centimeters was infested. As diameter goes up, the proportion of trees infested goes up too. And all of the six trees with diameter greater than 105 centimeters was infested. And for any invasive species, as I say, the first critical step is to detect early. So you focus on visual and the chemical interactions on this video. As we know, many videos use visual and chemical signals from plants and for host location. And this picture also shows G-sub has a well-developed eye and antenna. So several chemicals are chemicals that mediate interaction between two organisms, and the organism could be from the same species or different species. So for developing color traps, we have used two techniques. One is using an electrophysiological technique called electroretinographic analysis to measure G-sub sensitivity to light wavelength. Secondly, we scan the oak foliage of different oak species using spectrophotometer then determine the optimal wavelength and match the color of the to the wavelength. And this work is done by with our collaborator of Damon Crook at the University of Massachusetts. And here is an illustration of the electromagnetic action and beams of lights with different wavelengths cast on the head of an insect, and the electrical signal then was detected and recorded. Another electrophysiological technique that we used later on for screening chemicals is called GCVAD. And this work is also done with our collaborative demo group. And GCEAD is coupled with this chromatography, electro-antenna gravity detection. It's used for as rapid screening of compounds in a complex mixture. And here is an illustration of GCEAD, and samples were injected here, and then samples go through a very long column, they are separated here, then split into two halves, one go to a GC detector, so that we know what compound they are. The other half go to an antenna or an insect, again the electrical signal was detected and recorded. The retinal gland shows that GC are sensitive to quite a few of peaks. There are some in red area, blue area, blue, purple, and UV. Here are the colors that we developed. And these name of the colors are from paint tricks. So the result indicate that purple trap is the best color. So later on in our study, we used the purple trap as a control. And then we also scanned the foliages from different oak species, including preferred host coast live oak, intermediate host canyon live oak, and non-host ingleman oak. So here are the colors that we developed. This slide shows the results. As you can see very clearly, purple trap, regardless of male or female or the total, is the best trap. Then we also look at several chemicals of different sorts. First, we look at EAV pheromone and green leaf molecules. I have two definitions here. One is pheromone are semiochemicals chemicals that mediate interaction between two organisms from the same species. And green leaf molecules belong to pheromones. Pheromones are semiochemicals that mediate interactions between two organisms from different species. So the pheromones benefit the receiver, but not the emitter. We also look at the pheromones from oak bark and try to isolate G-sub pheromone. So Peter Silk, who is a research scientist from Canadian Forest Service, and his group, they isolated a EAV sex pheromone 3Z lecton from EAV female. And also they tested the isomer 3B lecton, and both of them elicited an antenna response to EAV males. So because EAV and GSOP are in the same genus, they are pretty closely related, they want to test these compounds to see if there are any cross attraction. And in their study, they also tested two green leaf molecules. One is a 3Z hexanol and 2B hexanol. Both of them elicited an antenna response. And both of these GLVs are also produced by oak trees. So we want to test these four compounds. Their study indicated that 3Z lecton increased the male EAV catches. Both lecton isomers increased the male EAV catches to 3Z hexanol. So here is our study site at Cleveland National Forest, about 30 miles east of San Diego County. Here is a specific study site, and they are released. For the EAV sex element and its isomer, we have 2.4 micrograms per day and risk rate. For the two GLBs, the risk rate is 17 and milligrams per day. And we also had a 2x2 combinations of these four compounds. And they made the trap as a control. So here, choose the results, and it's a more catches with very low. It's less than 1 liter per trap for 2 weeks. And unfortunately, there's no chill effect as well. And we conducted quite a few of the contrasts. For example, for this one, we compared the unbaited control with all the rest of traps that has either one or two lures. And it's not a significant. So after the field season, we got a chance to look at G-shock antenna response to EAD filaments and to green leaf volatiles in GCAD. Results indicate that neither G-shock female nor males are responsible to 3Z lectin, 3E lectin, and 3D hexanol. G-shock females are not responsible to 2E hexanol. However, there is something interesting. G-shock males are responsible to 2E hexanol, this compound 3 has shown here. So this result is both surprising and exciting. It's surprising because in the last season, we didn't see any attractiveness of 2E hexanol. Exciting because it elicited antenna response in G-shock males. So we still got a chance to develop a good rule. And so we want to test this compound for one more season in the same national forest. And we had two different risk rates, 17 milligrams per day as usual, and we increased the risk rate to 102. And we also included ethanol because many bark beetle and woodworm insects are attracted to ethanol. Ethanol is a sign of tree declining or fermentation. So here are the results. Again, the water catches are very low, less than 1 liter. And unfortunately, again, there's no treatment effect. None of the contrast we conducted was significant. So then we look at the pheromones from oak bark. We collected the bark and then extracted the volatiles and run GCEAD. Here are the GCEAD response to the males. These are a list of the compounds listed and antenna response. So we tested some of the combination. One is bark blank, which includes for all eight or 10 compounds, and the camping along, and the camping plus and from protein, and as you can see from this picture, none of these loop combinations are better than unbaited control. So far we also collected volatiles from G-shock females and males, and preliminary results indicate there's a different, there's some difference in the chemical profile picture here. So we are still now in the process of identifying this compound. And if we do find a G-shock pheromone, that will be very significant. So to summarize G-shock section, since its discovery in California, G-shock has been spreading pretty slowly. And purple chaper is the best color we have now. Many volatiles from oak box and oak foliage listed and general response, but they didn't do well in attraction of video in field. And now we are testing different combinations of different compounds, because in reality, insects they can sense a blend of chemicals. So we are testing three of the compounds of these different combinations. Lastly, let me talk about the prolific shortpool model. Prolific shortpool model was first discovered in Los Angeles County in 2003. It's probably introduced from Southeastern Asia. And this beetle is very closely associated with a fungus called the Fusarium dieback. And for the short bow model, females inoculate this fungus when establishing a gallery. And later on, both adults and larvae feed on this fungus, so they don't have to interact with tree chemistries very intensively. Here are some pictures of the pretty short bowl. This is a female, it's much larger, about twice the size of female, a male. And the color is also darker, and the males are whitish. And here are some different stages of the beetle. There's one egg here, different larval stages, pupa. And it allows both male and females all in the same gallery. Distributions in California, it was first discovered in Los Angeles County in 2003. Now has spread to Orange County, Riverside, San Bernardino, and San Diego County. San Diego County was first detected in 2003. I remember I have one picture I want to show you. This is this picture was taken this summer. And the sycamore tree has been completed. Small brown spots are the extables. The point I want to make is that although it was detected in 2003, but the tree has been cured. That means the beetle has been in San Diego for a few more years before the detection.
Detected
in 2013. 2013, yeah, I'm sorry. So if we did a survey earlier or more intensively, the distribution of G-Sop might be greater, broader. So the symptoms take a different form on different host plants. This one is on bookbox elder. The dark color is caused by the fungus. And this on coastline oak, you can see a bigger stain. And on avocado, the white stuff is called, they call the honey volcano. And on box elder, on castor bean, you wouldn't see stains. But on sycamore, you will see lots of stain. So according to scientists from UC Riverside, they surveyed that over 200 species are known host plants. Here are some examples. And the species highlighted in red are the species you might see very often at Davis. And now we are still testing different host trees from different states. And based on the ability of Bishop to establish a gallery, and all these six species are susceptible. So in the study, we forced a female Bishop to feed on a log. Then if they establish a new gallery, so in the gallery, in the beginning, there's only one female. Later on, you will see a male, female, and different larval stages. Then we said they are susceptible. And the species followed by a red star sign indicates the species has not been reported in host. So we had found four more species in California, and the species from Louisiana and New Mexico, or these four seven species are susceptible. And pollutation infestation in the field, infestation could go as high as 90% on box order and yellow species. And the mortality could go up to 30% box order and over 20%, almost 20% on red beetles and tetra bean. So as G-Sop, we want to see, want to develop a effective rules for protection. And because box elder is a preferred host, so we first test the box elder volatiles. And we have four treatments using the funnel trap control without any ethanol, the ethanol rule. for the two box elbow treatments, we hollowed the longer than filled with the water and the ethanol. Here is a picture of the study site, and the preliminary results indicate there are no treatment effects, although the treatment box elbow plus water will track more videos numerically, and also the overall catch was pretty low. So to summarize peripheral short loop model section, peripheral short loop model is running pretty fast in California, and could be a really big threat to hardwood trees due to its broader host range. And its complete host range is still unknown. We are testing different host trees from various states, and many species from Louisiana and New Mexico are susceptible. Short loop model is not attracted to ethanol, a signal of plant fermentation. And in the future, we are focused on collecting volatiles from different oaks, different host trees, and then test their efficacy. So to summarize my talk, many hardwood trees are endangered by many invasive food borers. And for the two agrilos species, EAB seems to be spreading much faster than GSOL. One reason may be that EAB infests trees of all size, while GSOL prefers bigger trees. And also, the living phloem of oak trees is much thicker than ash trees. So the oak trees can sustain more populations of GSOL, and before they can move, they must move to new areas. And developing plant-based tracking techniques for waterboarding is very challenging. And so far, we purple tracker is the best color we tested, and no effective rules for peripheral short loop model and GSOL. And both EAB and GSOL, and they limited their host range to trees in one genus. However, peripheral short loop model has really broad host range, and perhaps because peripheral short loop model, they feed on fungi, so they don't have to interact chemically with oak trees intensively as the other two species. So thank you for your attention, and I will take any questions you have.
Question, I want to say I neglected my introductory comments to note that Marion Flint played a really big role in bringing him to us as a group, and supervision was a really major part of our crew on the G7. So I just forgot to say, I'm sorry. So any questions for Egan?
Yes. Yeah, what's your questions on the biology of these species? Do you know whether any of these produce sound?
No, and what?
Do they produce sound? Any sound?
I'm pretty sure the larvae, when feeding, they will produce sound.
But the adults do not. They don't have any wing vibration, not, I mean, or any movement of the body that produces sound.
Is that for mating or more any?
Possibly.
As far as I know, I'm not aware.
Whatever means by which insects attract each other, including beetles. So, and because the male will often be attracted to a female sound, or vice versa.
Yeah, and I'm not aware. I haven't seen any report on the adults, but we did actually for the larvae, we recorded the vibration of different stages of the larvae, and the later the stage, and the greater the implication. So that's all I know about.
And so any indication that the adults are attracted to larval sound?
Are the adults
attracted to larval sound? It would be one way to increase the attack rate on a tree.
I don't know if they are attracted by sound or some other signals. It's possible by the kind of tree. It's possible. I know trees of they prefer previously infested trees. So that obviously they have some signals that actually
do the bales multiply mate, or is it a single mate?
Males can mate multiple times. There's a female. Females, I don't know. Males can mate many times.
And so they move in fact from tree to tree or from female to female.
For EAB, I know they move tree to tree, but for G-Sub, actually we haven't seen any G-Sub in the field besides beetles we caught in the traps.
Most of the adults are up in the crown of the trees. Most of the adults are up in the crown, that's where the males and females.
Maybe take place in the crown.
I think so. The females come down.
They come down
a little less than that.
The males stay up in the crown and multiply mate?
We think so. I mean, I don't know what the multiple mean. That's probably been observed in the lab.
Well, the implication here is that, you know, if males can mate with many females, then, you know, the strategy would seem to be, you know, in terms of trapping would be, you know, get the female.
Mm.
So you're aiming your trapping techniques at catching the female.
Yeah.
There's
a really strong visual component to this. With EAB, where they've worked on this a lot more, they've actually used models and pinned insects, and the males come down and sort of parachute down on the females so they see them. And that's why this purple color is probably so important. It's related to the color coming off of the females.
So when the females emerge, they then fly from tree to tree, or do they just fly once?
I don't know, everyone knows so far. We haven't seen any behavior. It's possible. I wouldn't say anything. I mean, nobody knows. I haven't seen any reports about this. But I know, I mean, as Steve said, they use this visual for male finding. When you watch a video of a female, the males will still land on the dead males. So obviously they are using visual signals for mate finding.
The males are the dead females.
Dead females.
Yeah. Any other questions? Getting back to sound, that ambrosia beetle, we don't know anything about that. A lot of bark beetles scrape delay. That could be that going on. But you know, in this case the males stay in that tunnel most of the time and mate with the sisters. And so the male doesn't disperse at all, doesn't come out on the surface. And so all the mating that goes on, the females really just need to board and start laying eggs. And they have been mated previously by their brothers, so they don't really do much anything in the new gallery. They're probably going to mate with this male. But
so when they depart, do they depart after mating?
The females don't depart, they mate. Yeah, they depart after mating. Yeah, this is the root of the virus.
The idea of the larval, some vibrations or something actually attracting adult beetles to trees is, I think, a really interesting idea, which I don't think has been tested.
Sort of fixated on whether there's odors on those.
Yeah, no, I think that's very interesting. But we never see the adults in the field. We never see them. It's amazing. We spend hours and days out there monitoring and the only time you ever find them is in the traps. So it's hard to work with these insects, the adults, because there's stuff there.
Well, there's also some notion that the vibrations of the larvae are attracting the woodpeckers. So the woodpeckers are foraging up and down these trees, and they're probably sensing the larvae there from their sound. So there's sort of a heterotrophic level of interaction. So. Okay, if there's no other questions, well, thank you for a really nice. Oh, here's
one. I have one small question. So you said that PSHB is not attracted to ethanol, like a sign of fermentation of a dying tree.
EAB?
PSHB, the polyphagous shock spore. I'm curious if there's a trend in the kind of trees that Polypus shadow borer attacks. Do they attack dying trees versus living trees? Is there no variation in that? Would that be a potential explanation for why they aren't attractive to the ethanol, or they're attracted to the ethanol?
Seems like they attack and healthy trees too. At least for like a box elder, as far as I know. And I don't know if they prefer a previously infested tree. I believe they attack healthy trees.
Okay.
So within the sort of spectrum of these ambrosia beetles, a lot of them like to climb and use fermenting. They all respond to the ethanol. This one is more like a primary insect, almost like our pine bark beetles with Sierra Nevada. It comes into healthy trees.
Okay.
So it's pretty unusual ambrosia beetle, and that does, you know, explain why they're not going after ethanol in our experiments.
Okay, great.
Thank you. There are a whole second wave of ambrosia beetles that do come to those trees, even though the local shovel board is there, and they are going to the fermentation process later.
Okay.
So sort of later in the shovel.
All right, that makes more sense.
That's really a good question. I was at a workshop yesterday, we had that same discussion.
Okay, great.
Okay, well, thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.